Good evening and welcome to the fourth presentation in this, our 15th season of talks on Kentucky Live, Southern Culture at its Best, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries. My name is Brian Coots, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services at WKU, I coordinate this series with help from our webmaster, Haiwang Wan, and our facilities specialist, Daniel Peach. Katie Reuter and Chris DeMeo designed our posters. And our technical specialist tonight is Isaac Russell. Our speaker tonight is a native of Rome, Georgia, where her parents moved when her father, Stan, accepted a position on the faculty of Berry College in 1973. She attended Rome High School, where she was an honor student and an athlete. Growing up, she thought she wanted to be a physical therapist until she took her first college biology course. She majored in history at the University of Tennessee, where she won the prize for the best senior thesis in 1998. She added an M.Ed. from Berry College in 2001 and a Ph.D. from Georgia State in 2009. She says she was heavily influenced by some amazing college professors, including Lori Glover, Dwayne Corpus, Wendy Vanette, and Larry Youngs, who inspired her love of historical research and writing and taught her the skills to do both. She joined the faculty at the Harpeth Hall School in Nashville, Tennessee in 2007, where she teaches honors U.S. history and serves as departmental chair and digital humanities coordinator. In 2012, she began teaching as an adjunct at Belmont University and was named a Global Leadership Studies Fellow in 2016. Her books include Berry College, A Century of Making Music, published by Arcadia Press in 2010 to commemorate 100 years of music at the college, All Girls Education, from Ward Seminary to Harpeth Hall, 1865 to 2015, published by Arcadia in 2015, A Heartfelt Mission, the West End Home Foundation, 1891 to 2016, which tells the history of a home built to assist the Civil War's many widows. And most recently, Athens of the New South, College Life and the Making of Modern Nashville, published in 2017 by the University of Tennessee Press, which is the theme of tonight's talk. She's currently working on Nashville Sites, a mobile-friendly digital project that provides self-guided walking tours for historically and culturally significant sites in Nashville's downtown and surrounding areas. Please give a warm welcome to Mary Ellen Pethel. Mary Ellen.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Brian, for your invitation, for all of you for coming. As you might have noted, I've written three books in 4 years, so I'm gonna take a break. And so I've moved digital now, and so hopefully, if we have a little bit of time at the end, I'll explain Nashville Sites, which is really just getting started in earnest this summer. But Athens of the New South, College Life and the Making of Modern Nashville, was a project that began with my dissertation in 2008. And originally, it was looking at a smaller time period, and the chapters were not quite as long as they were became in the book. I was able to expand on this topic once UT Press accepted it for publication. But this project has really led to so many fruitful discussions in Nashville and with Nashville's history, and there are so many anniversaries that are coming up. One of the things that I note is that this period from 1865 to 1930 was a period where you had so many schools that were opened. And so, especially given that year, 1865, you fast forward 125 years, 150 years, so many, many schools are celebrating major anniversaries. And so that made working on this project and this book even more special because so many schools are turning 125, 150 and celebrating these major milestones. So to begin here, and I'll hold up a copy of the book as well. The cover turned out so well with UT Press, and that's the cover shot there. But if you are able to open up the book all the way, here, then you can see that it's part of a larger frame here. And so this is an architectural rendering from the 1897 Centennial Tennessee Exposition to celebrate 100 years of statehood in Nashville. And so one of the reasons that this cover shot was chosen was because at the center of the Centennial Exposition was the Parthenon. And the Parthenon was very deliberately chosen to showcase Nashville's commitment and dedication to higher education. If you look here to the left, just a brief chronology is going to explain and show you the different schools that were that have come to Nashville between 1826 and 1913. But as you can see with the University of Nashville, that was 1826. But after that, you skip all the way really to 1864. So what you end up having are nine different schools that are going to come into being between essentially the end of the Civil War and 1913. Almost all of these schools are still currently active or are active post-merger with other colleges, and I'll explain some of that in just a second. To give you a quick rundown of the different types of schools that we have here, we have Roger Williams University, which opened in 1864. It was a college for freedmen and women, and it mostly trained preachers and teachers for African American schools. If any of you are familiar with Nashville and you know where Vanderbilt University is, just across the street from Vanderbilt is Peabody, which was its own college for many, many years, but is now the School of Education for Vanderbilt. That was the original campus for Roger Williams University. It had two mysterious fires in 1905 and 1909. And ultimately moved to North Nashville and then merged with Lemoyne Owen College in Memphis, which is still today an HBCU. But that's where their original campus was. We had Ward Seminary, which was downtown. It was an all-female academy, opened in 1865 with a man named Dr. William Ward and his wife, Eliza. We had Fisk University, opened in 1866, which became one of the most well-known HBCUs even in its day. Fisk and Howard were considered the top two universities for African Americans really in the country. Vanderbilt University, of course, which is considered in some ways the Southern Ivy. It is going to be 1873. Endowed with $1 million from Cornelius Vanderbilt, who never stepped foot on campus. So he never saw the university. The panic of 1873 hit right after he made that donation. So Vanderbilt lucked up in him making that donation before the Depression and the recession hit. But he never came to campus, never visited. Peabody Normal School, just 2 years later, originally began downtown before moving out across the street from Vanderbilt. And that you always talk about normal schools. What do they mean when they say normal schools? And of course, they were really teaching education courses because there was such an explosion of primary and secondary schools and they needed teachers to teach in those schools. You also had the shift in education, the education profession, from men to women in large part. So you have more and more women also wanting to go to school, and normal schools were a pretty hot destination for women who wanted to teach. But they called them normal schools. That was something when I first began my research that I didn't really understand, and that is because they were teaching what they deemed a normal education course. And so what we call that today is gen ed. So that's why they called it a normal versus that classical idea of the university education where you specialized in something. So that's why they called it that. Peabody's going to exist as its own college, independent, and later become the George Peabody College for Teachers until the 1970s. And at that time, then they are going to merge and with Vanderbilt and become Vanderbilt School of Education. Central Tennessee College in 1876. That might not sound like a school that you're familiar with today, but you do know the school that emerged from it. Its medical department was called Meharry. And so Meharry Medical College was born from Central Tennessee College, which was also for freedmen and women. Meharry's going to begin downtown and then move out beside near Fisk in 1930. Belmont College, which began on an antebellum estate for Adelicia Acklin, one of the wealthiest women in the South and, in fact, the nation before the Civil War. After she passed away, the estate was sold, and a lot of it was sectioned off to create the current-day Hillsborough-Belmont neighborhood. But the main part of the estate, including the mansion, was kept intact, and it was bought by two women, Susan and Ida Hood and Susan Heron, and they opened the school for young women, the Belmont College School for Young Women. Then we have Nashville Bible College, another one that might not seem like you know what it is or that it still exists, but you do. It's Lipscomb University. Nashville Bible College began as a Bible college, again training mostly teachers and preachers. So Roger Williams trained African-American teachers and preachers, Nashville Bible College, white men and women. And it's going to be renamed David Lipscomb College in 1917 after David Lipscomb passes away. So it's named in his honor. He was the founder. And then Tennessee Agricultural and Industrial Normal School, which later became known as Tennessee A&I, but today we know that as TSU, Tennessee State University. And then finally, one where it really is just a merger. Ward Seminary and Belmont School for Young Women are going to merge to form Ward Belmont School, which will serve as a women's junior college, music conservatory, and college preparatory school. And they will operate as such until 1951. And at that time, they go out of business after being purchased by the Tennessee Baptist Convention, who reopens a four-year co-ed liberal arts college. And a lot of the Ward Belmont women stayed and completed their college careers there. And then the college preparatory division of Ward Belmont, that did not reopen with Belmont University, decided that they wanted to move out a little further west, and that became Harpeth Hall School, which is the school where I teach. So I always refer to it as the former high school division of the Ward Belmont School. And that is why Harpeth Hall dates back to 1865, with those roots going all the way back to Ward Seminary. So that's just a quick little tour and chronology of the schools themselves. But now let me give you a quick tour of Nashville by 1865. Nashville was different. And one of the things I am really arguing in the book is, how and why is Nashville different from other southern cities in its development, particularly after the Civil War? And the answer to that question is, in large part, I argue, higher education. They're very, the business community, the education community, the cultural arts community, all coming together and emphasizing higher education and embracing higher education as a way to rebuild the city, in addition to industry as well. Nashville, just as a city, it was a little different anyway, because it was the first southern city to be occupied by Union forces. And so, as a lot of other southern cities experienced massive destruction during the Civil War, Nashville was able to escape a lot of that. So Nashville, in many ways, was perhaps best poised to follow a New South vision, because it was also willing to work with northern industry and transportation and welcomed institutions of higher education. If you've been to Nashville before, you might recognize the building on top of that hill. Does anyone recognize what that building is?
Capitol.
It's the state capitol. You're exactly right. And so if you are thinking about what angle you might be looking at the capitol, this is an area today known as the Gulch. Are y'all familiar with the Gulch? So Union Station had not yet been built, and so that's why you don't see Union Station, although it would be right about here. And so you see the rail yards. Let me show you a picture of what is there today. You ready? Quite a transformation. So this is the Gulch today, which is now one of the hippest, hottest areas to live in Nashville, not to mention expensive. And so, you know, I go there every now and again for a meal, but that's about all I can afford. So the Centennial Exposition of 1897, and this is the full rendering of this cover that I showed you earlier, and actually this is a better quality picture as well. It's got the, if you look at the cover, you can see they had to crop some of it to get it to center and format correctly. But you can see in that one, you've got the industry with the smokestacks coming up there. You can see off in the distance the hills and the balloon. But it was the Centennial Exposition that really encapsulated and projected Nashville the Nashville that we wanted the world to see. And so choosing that Parthenon, once again, was a very very deliberate decision to do that. And so I say here, Nashville proclaimed its urban modernity to the world with the Centennial Exposition in 1897, located just west of downtown. Although the exposition was a celebration of the statehood of Tennessee, this year-long World Fair-style event reflected Nashville's commitment to education, culture, and the arts. It was also a boost to the city's economy and helped to put Nashville on the commercial map. If you're thinking about World's Fairs just in general, there are two really big ones that happen in Atlanta. There's a big one that happens in Charleston. This is pretty common. This is the way that you are trying to sell your city and bring people to your city to live and to work. Chicago Exposition is probably the most famous, also known as the White City in 1893. So this was the Nashville Centennial was in large part modeled after the exposition in Chicago in 1893 with the classical Greco-Roman architectural style. So speaking of, here are a few pictures from the Centennial Exposition. On the top left, you'll see the entrance gates. On the top right, you'll see the Parthenon with the new electric lights, as they called them. And then you see another pyramid that's outlined in lights. That was to represent Memphis. Bottom right here, we have the agricultural building. And then bottom left, this just gives you a little bit of the landscape of the entire exposition, but also shows you the crowds and some of the attractions that they had. They actually built a man-made lake that is still there outside of the Parthenon. And they had they recreated a Rialto Bridge and had Venetian gondola rides and the streets of Cairo. It was very Epcot Center. It's a small world after all at the Centennial Exposition. And I always like to point out in the very back there, the Chicago Exposition's big ride was the Ferris wheel. That was their big invention. So Nashville's was, I guess, what we would deem today like a tilt-a-wheel, I'm not really sure, or a slingshot. But do you see that in the very back right here? So that ride actually is a box that has people in it, and it's just flinging them back and forth across the sky. And I always think, no way would you ever get me on that thing. But anyway, just a taste of this. So that is going to last for 6 months, but as you probably know, with a lot of these fairs, they are not meant to be permanent. They're semi-permanent structures, mostly made out of plaster, and at that time, a certain kind of type of plywood. And so they came down, but they decided to leave the Parthenon. They leave the Parthenon, and it stands for another 25 years, and it begins to go into disrepair. And it's at that time that really Nashville has solidified itself as the Athens of the South. And so they decide it's worth the money and the time, the effort, to permanently rebuild a replica of the Parthenon, which they do and complete in the 1930s. And I always say that really solidifies the image of Nashville as Athens of the South. You know, we're known best as perhaps Music City, but we wouldn't be Music City without Athens of the South, at least I think. So we were doing things so well after the Civil War, in terms of the way that we were developing and the different ways in which we were trying to generate interest and generate people moving to Nashville, that other southern cities actually came to Nashville to see what we were doing right. And so this is a quote from the Birmingham Ledger in 1914. The people of Nashville have learned the financial side of education institutions, as well as the refining influence of its colleges and schools. And that is really a big key. A group known as the business progressives, or perhaps the civic commercial elite, they were there to make money and create business and industry, but they recognized the value of higher education. Another big part of this is that they also had their sons and daughters attending school, and they wanted them to be able to go to good schools and not be forced to leave Nashville in order to attend to get a good quality education. Another big factor in the development of Nashville, and one in which the institution of higher education play a major role, is the development of the city as it moves west. So this is Weston Avenue, which is one of the main drags where you would find Vanderbilt University. Nashville right now, as you might have heard in the news, is going through a lot of talk about transit and doing a huge new mass transit program. And I always say, if you just look at this picture, you see we had it figured out a century ago, and then we got rid of the streetcars, and now we're trying to bring them back. So this is Weston Avenue here. This is another pretty big street in Nashville known as Woodmont Avenue. So they're cutting Woodmont Avenue. It was originally called Concrete Avenue because this was pre-asphalt. So the entire thing was this massive undertaking because they cut this major road and it was all concrete. And then finally, as you see things moving west, you also see wealth moving west. And that there's a definite relationship between this wealth moving west and these colleges that are almost all private, also moving wealth, moving west along with that wealth. So this is a picture of 1916, just 102 years ago, of the opening of the Belmead Country Club. And as you might know, Belmead is still one of the most prestigious neighborhoods in the country. And home to Steeplechase, of course. So just to give you a little bit of, to pull back and give you a larger overview of where these schools are, if you see to the northwest, the three circles along the top there, those are all of the African-American HBCU. You've got Fisk, TSU, and Meharry. If you see the one that's closer to the river here, that's going to be the University of Nashville, which is going to remain downtown. One interesting thing about the University of Nashville, however, is that's where Peabody actually started. It started as the educational department of the University of Nashville. But it's going to remain downtown, and it will actually not reopen. It pretty much closes, for all intents and purposes, by 1909. And then the schools that you see in the southwest, those are Vanderbilt University, Belmont College, which becomes Ward Belmont, Nashville Bible College, which is Lipscomb, and then at that time still Roger Williams. So what about Vanderbilt University and the emerging Southern Ivy School? I mentioned earlier that people wanted to be able to send their sons and daughters to good schools in the South. And not send them, as I read in several places, not have to send them to the Yankee schools. So it wasn't just Vanderbilt. Some of the others are Trinity, which is Duke University, and also Emory. Those are probably the three that all opened during this period that are seen as really good schools in the South, private schools. And almost all of them have religious affiliations, at least to a certain point. Vanderbilt's going to break with the Methodists, for example, in 1915. But if you look in this picture, on the bottom left is James Kirkland, who served as the Chancellor of Vanderbilt University from 1893 to 1937. That is a long time. He also went through a lot of different facial hair phases in doing my research. He went from full long beards to these strange goatees, and then he ends up just with sideburns. But he's got an interesting look here. The guy that is sitting on the bottom right, who has his hand in his breast pocket, that is actually a man named William Dudley. And he is going to be in charge of sports at Vanderbilt. And I'll talk about sports in just a second, but he is one of the guys who recognizes that sports really need to be codified. They were just a little out of control. There's a lot of rampant cheating. You had coaches who played and players who coached. People could play for 6 or 7 years. If you really needed somebody who was, going to be a great quarterback, you could go downtown and recruit somebody, just for the game. So he realized that there really needed to be more rules and reform, because football is a fairly new sport. And so he went with several other people down to Atlanta, and they sat down and they wrote out some rules, and they formed the Southern Intercollegiate Athletic Association, today known as the SEC. So he is the father of the SEC. Here's a picture of some Vanderbilt students in 1904. You do see some women there. Vanderbilt did accept women from its inception, but they always called them special students, or one of my favorites, irregular. I always feel like that's such a bummer for them. But they were allowed into Vanderbilt, but they were called irregular students or special students because they were essentially only allowed to register for courses that had not yet been filled by the men. And they were also precluded from some of the degree tracks as well. Nonetheless, women were there from its inception, and they're going to be, by 1920, about 20% of the student body. So the University of Nashville downtown, that, as I mentioned, Peabody College started at its education department. Then after the University of Nashville does not reopen, Peabody College remains open and moves out next door to Vanderbilt after Roger Williams' second fire in 1909. Again, mysterious fires, never determined the cause of that, so likely arson, but they are going to rebuild a completely brand new campus and reopen in 1912. They become a think tank of Southern education throughout the South. And then, as I mentioned earlier, they're going to merge with Vanderbilt in the 1970s. But one of the big things I think also to take away from this, and I know I've only just briefly mentioned the schools, is that it wasn't just that there was the quantity of schools in Nashville. It was also the quality of schools. You know, Peabody was one of the nation's leading teacher education schools. Vanderbilt was one of the leading private universities in the South and in the nation. Where Belmont was a leading women's school. Fisk was a leading HBCU. Meharry was one of just five or six medical schools for African Americans. So that's another big part of this. And that leads me then to a chapter that I call The Race for Education. Actually that's the subtitle. The main title is The Talented Tenth. And so I argue that Nashville was both a mecca and a magnet for black liberal arts and professional education, as it carried with it the hope of ultimate participation in an emergent black middle and elite class. But then a quote by the great W.B. Du Bois in the book, The Talented Tenth, he did not coin that phrase. It was actually a man named Henry Morehouse. But he used that phrase and then, of course, wrote the book, The Talented Tenth, which is an amazing read if you haven't had the chance to check it out. And a quote from that book, education and work at the levers to uplift the people. Work alone will not do it unless inspired by the right ideals and guided by intelligence. Education must not simply teach work, it must teach life. So you had two pretty distinct parallel tracks for African American education in this era. You had what was known as more of the industrial or vocational model, and that was mostly purported by Booker T. Washington. And then you had more of the talented tenth professional model as illustrated by W.B. Du Bois, who argued that instead of sort of rising from within, that you actually needed to start off with a talented tenth, that you needed a black professional class immediately because you needed black doctors and lawyers and nurses and pharmacists. And the Booker T. Washington model was more about job skills and training. So you had both of those in Nashville. You had Roger Williams, which was a little bit more of the industrial vocational teaching, getting African Americans ready to teach or ready to go into the pulpit. And then TSU is also going to follow the industrial vocational model. But Fisk is going to be very different, as is Meharry Medical College. This is an extraordinary photograph that I was able to get permission to put in the book. From the Meharry archives. And so this is one of their longtime surgeons, Dr. Boyd, that you see seated right here with the glasses. And this is a surgery. This is a photo of a surgery. There's a person under that sheet who looks like, with the bottle sitting there, has just been given a dose of chloroform and has been knocked out. But this is a surgical procedure that you see so few action shots like this, if you will. And then you see a science class at Fisk, and this is in 1930. You can tell even from this that this is you're seeing by 1930, this is the product of a black professional class and the emergence of a black middle class that is coming out of Fisk as graduates. Finally, Tennessee A&I, it's really the only public school that is in Nashville, and especially in this era, and it was the state's first publicly funded HBCU. The school opened in 1912 with 230 students. By 1929, it had over 2,000 students. There was certainly a need there. William J. Hale was the president for 32 years. College degrees were first awarded in 1924. And then the school's name was changed to Tennessee State University in 1968. So then looking at a couple of other topics here, the modern bell. So women play a really interesting role in this era. because I call them the modern belle, because if you think about Southern women before the Civil War, you have this Scarlett O'Hara image, you know, and then you think about women in the 1920s, and you're thinking in that flapper kind of era. And I'm saying what we mostly have in urban areas like Nashville is a hybrid between the two. And so I call this figure the modern belle. And it really was a convention versus compromise that produced education for women in both single-sex and co-educational settings. So you had women at places like Vanderbilt, but then you also had this alternative lane of education for women in schools like Ward Belmont. And in many ways, those were more culturally acceptable because it didn't have the masculinity of that traditional university, and yet they were still able to attend institutions of higher education. So this period is very interesting when you're looking at the role of women and you're looking at the role of women's higher education. Some of what comes out of this, and talking about those parallel lanes, new curricular options. I actually call this in the book genderfication, because you have new majors that are really just for women. Things like nursing, teaching is predominantly women, and then domestic science, which we would identify probably more now with home economics. So this great picture is from a yearbook from Belmont School for Young Women. She took domestic science at Belmont. He took football at Vanderbilt, just kind of showing that dichotomy of how they're seeing men and women go to schools differently. I also say that Southern women continued to wrestle with notions where they were expected, on the one hand, to have to show a lot of fortitude, but also to show a lot of femininity. And I really do put that phrase, steel magnolias. I feel like that's also, that the steel magnolia is also sort of a metaphor for the modern belle in a lot of ways. But overall, higher education was a vehicle that provided new opportunities for women in education, and in fact, agency as well. It's not that most of these women did not go on to get married pretty soon after they graduated, if not engaged while they were still in school. These women's schools, they all wore white dresses and had May Day festivals. It was part of the courtship ritual, and you know, they graduate and then have cotillion the next month and then be married the next month. So it's not that's totally going to change, but what does change is that they have some options they did not have before. So here is a picture of Ward Seminary students. You see them in their dresses with their sashes. They are not going to a suffrage march. They're actually going to the Centennial Exposition. They had a special Ward Seminary Day. People always ask me, with these women's schools in Nashville, did you have a lot of women's suffrage movements? And you did have Ann Dallas Dudley, who was a Ward Seminary graduate. She was a big leader in women's suffrage nationally. But she was an alum by the time that all happened. These women's schools, for the most part, they were a little fearful of being too political. And so you do not see a lot of activism on women's college campuses. There's the campus of Belmont College. You can see there's the mansion there in the middle, flanked by two of the original buildings, Fidelity Hall and Friendship Hall, both of which are still there, as is the mansion. And if you've never been to the Belmont Mansion, has anybody ever been to the Belmont Mansion? It is definitely worth a trip. It is fantastic. It was completed, I believe, in 1849 or 1850, something like that. So then the final two topics, and then I'll wrap up and answer any questions that you might have. You know, the subtitle of this book is College Life and Making Modern Nashville. And so one of the things that I have always been so interested in is, how do we get this modern notion of college life? You know, college life in many ways is now like a little petri dish for adulthood. You have some responsibility, but not all responsibility. You're still figuring things out, but you are adults and are emancipated from your parents. And so if you think about modern college life, I think it's pretty easy to say clubs, fraternities, sororities, gen ed courses, majors, and certainly college sports. And that is also what I look to try to go back and find the origins of this, and then to trace the shifts of these different things to see the modern iterations that we have today on a college campus. So this is a picture here from a yearbook, I believe 1922, from Vanderbilt, and this is a college fraternity page in the yearbook. And you can see, even down on the bottom right there, where the guy's on his shoulders, even something that seems as tame as that was a little scandalous in a yearbook in 1922. All of the pictures, they're very stiff. Nobody's smiling. They're not spontaneous at all. So even just showing frivolity on campus in this way is where you see how things have progressed throughout this period. So you have this new modern youth culture that permeates Nashville downtown, because the kids are going to school, some of them from Nashville, but also the other goal of Nashville is that you're attracting the best and the brightest to Nashville to go to your schools, and hopefully they'll also stay and work after they graduate. But they are feeding the city. They're going to the pool halls, they're going to the dance halls, they're going to the movies, they're going to concerts. They're deciding what kind of music is popular. And at the same time, the city is also informing the colleges. So there's this very cyclical relationship where the cities are shaping the colleges, but the colleges are also certainly shaping the city. So coming out of this, we have fraternities, sororities, and sports that are going to allow one of the fundamental changes in modern college life, and that is casual relationships between men and women. Prior to, and even through part of this period, in order for men and women to socialize, there had to be formal invitations. Many times there had to be written parental permission. You almost always had chaperones who never left you alone. And so coming out of this, then you start to really see the tipping point, I would say, between 1910 and 1915. And so prior to that, you really only had very few occasions where you had co-eds that were mixing. One great example of this intersection that I thought I would share with you, there was a huge insurance company downtown called the National Life and Accident Company. And so their motto was, "We shield millions." And so they decided they wanted to go on this big advertising campaign, and they thought, well, radio's new, it's pretty cheap. Why don't we just start it on a radio station, and then we can have unlimited advertising for free because we own the station. So that's what they did, and so they called it WSM after their motto, "We Shield Millions." And it was that radio station that ultimately produced in 1925 something that was announced as the Grand Ole Opry, and obviously has led to another huge part of what makes Nashville, Nashville. The way I say that's an intersection is because some of the very people who helped to make that happen were graduates of these schools, not only who performed, but also who were in the audience. Perhaps the most famous is going to be Minnie Pearl, whose name was Sarah Cannon. She was a graduate of Ward Belmont. And this is a very young Minnie Pearl. If you guys know Minnie Pearl, you're probably used to seeing the older Minnie Pearl. She's so young right here, she hasn't even added the price tag to her hat part of the routine. And there she stands with the WSM motto. She's going to be a member of the Grand Ole Opry. So she's a great example of that intersection. Prior to being able to mix and mingle casually, you had to do a lot of what I call in the book, and this is not a term that I created. It was actually Kathy Pice in a book called Cheap Amusements. But it's a term called homosocial versus heterosocial interaction. So homosocial is where you're basically going in single-sex groups and just socializing with one another. Whereas heterosocial is where you've got men and women that are starting off separate but then are coming together. So this is an example of that homosocial kind of get-together, and they called these manless dances. They also sometimes had manless weddings, which I think is even stranger. But so they had to do this because this was more acceptable than, or in fact was acceptable, whereas them dancing with men that they did not know was wholly unacceptable. And so, once again, that's 1910. Now let me show you by 1930. By 1930, you are having parties galore, and the fraternities and sororities have now established houses off campus where they're even further outside of the purview of the administration, which the administration is not very fond of. But they allow it to happen because it keeps bringing kids in. This is a picture that's similar to a ball that they had. You guys know Mammoth Cave, obviously. Vanderbilt and Ward Belmont students went every year to Mammoth Cave and went down in the cave and had a massive party. And so, again, you see the men and women dancing here. The funny thing about these kinds of events, especially these cave dances, which were pretty common, but And still are, so I'm told. But because the pressure was different and a lot of different conditions in a cave, that a lot of times they would get so intoxicated that they would have a hard time getting out of the cave because it, as that pressure would change as they emerged. And then finally, sports. I think sports is the final piece of this puzzle if you're looking at modern college life. This is Vanderbilt football in 1900. Believe it or not, Vanderbilt dominated national football for about 35 years. Now, after the mid-1920s, they sunk somewhere in the middle, and they've been somewhere around in there ever since, we'll say. But they dominated. Nobody beat them. They crushed Alabama, Auburn, Georgia up until 1922. How does football fit into this, and is there an explanation for thinking about college sports and the South in particular? Because, as you might know, we're a little obsessed with football. This is a quote that I found that may have unlocked the mystery for me. This is from Coach Dan McGugan to the Vanderbilt football team prior to their 1922 game against Michigan. The quote was, "You are going against Yankees, some of whose grandfathers killed your grandfathers in the Civil War." To me, what helps to make this clear is that the South was working to restore its pride and its honor. And so in some ways, football became sort of an honor, a ritual of honor. It became honor contest, even among schools in the South, but certainly when you played a school outside of the South. And I think in large part, I don't think it's the only reason, but I think it's a major factor in why college football resonated, or why football resonated so within the South in particular. By the way, Dan McGugan was from Michigan. So he basically, as most really good coaches, just really knew how to fire up his guys. He knew exactly what to say. So how do we see this then? How do we see college sports taking over? Well, this is Dudley Field in 1900, which was essentially a big mowed field with some wooden bleachers on it. There are some college football players there. This is the true Leatherhead era of the Leatherheads. And there's Dudley Stadium in 1922. They erect these modern concrete coliseums in order to create truly a spectator sport. And they built it further out from campus. And you can see there from that aerial view, it's built actually just like the Yale Bowl. It's a horseshoe bowl. It's got lots of room around it. And now by the 1920s, you also have cars. And so people are driving to the games. They move the stadiums out a little bit. They create lots of parking lots. And then another new phenomenon follows, and that's called tailgating. Because people are driving in from out of town, so they want to sit around. They want to get ready for the game. They want to enjoy themselves. And so these two things are happening together. But it is a little odd. It's an odd relationship because you have the ivory tower, you know, that represents a certain set of ideals, and then you have college sports, and in particular football, which is not very refined. And so it is this strange mix, and a lot of schools struggle with this. It's one reason why Vanderbilt separated from the Methodists, because the Methodists wanted them to outlaw football. It's another reason why Emory never really had a team, because the Methodists didn't want them to have football. So this is a bit of a quandary, but ultimately administrators realized that they are attracting a lot of students because of football, because it brings college spirit. And secondly, it's the first thing they found that really engages the community, the outside community. If you think about a lot of college football fans today, a lot of them have never actually stepped foot in as an enrolled student in a classroom of the university that they love, right? But they're still fans of the game. And so that's the perfect example of how you see this lasting relationship between the college and the community because of sports. So just to wrap up then, the last chapter I talk about Athens of the New South. So in the title of the book, I'm referring to the New South as a historical era from 1865 to 1930. But in the last chapter, I really wanted to pull the thread through and be able to try to link it to how I see higher education today, and to show that, to pull that narrative all the way through to the present. And so for this chapter, for the last chapter, I spent the first few pages talking about the 1930s through, say, the 1990s or so, and talking about integration, not only racial integration, but more women attending colleges, so a lot of women's schools going closing or merging, like Ward Belmont did. But then also the interviewing community leaders today in Nashville and talking about, all right, so are we still Athens of the South? What does higher education do for Nashville today? We had this reputation, but what is its relevance today? So I have great quotes from the AD of Vanderbilt, and David Williams, Mayor Megan Berry, Edie Carroll Johnson of Vanderbilt Children's Hospital, lots of quotes from different administrators and college students alike. So I thought these two quotes were interesting. That same newspaper in 1914 quoted a local businessman in Nashville that said, "We figured out a university has an average attendance of 1,000 is worth infinitely more to a city than a steel plant or an industry that gives employment to 1,000 men." Martha Rivers Ingram, whose name you might know, a very influential Nashvillian whose family dates back to the early 1900s, and she's a big proponent of higher education and is a long time, I think she is a trustee emeritus now, but of Vanderbilt University. She said, "Nashville's value as a regional urban center is measured by its industry and innovation, yes, but the soul of the city is found in Nashville's love of music and the arts, sense of community, and a commitment to higher education." And I was struck by those two quotes because I feel like, in large part, they're saying the same thing. You know, and for Nashville, they have decided that a rising tide lifts all boats. And if you bring great people to the city, then they will stay in the city. If you have great people who grow up in the city, they stay in the city. That's the idea, and you're creating this cycle. So some quick statistics here that I think help to show this. I won't read them all to you. You can glance at them, but total over 90,000 students in higher education in Nashville and over 21 institutions. Now that includes all community colleges and even some for-profit universities. Belmont and Lipscomb in particular have emerged as national universities. You look at Belmont University 25 years ago with an enrollment of probably close to 2,500, and now they're pushing 9,000. Lipscomb is not too far behind. I think they're more right now between 6,000 and 7,000. TSU is the second largest university in the city, 9,000 students. 55.5% of the adults over 25 have at least one or more years of college. And this is, I think, a key statistic. Approximately 60% of the local college graduates stay and work and live in Middle Tennessee. So that's an example of that cyclical relationship. So as a whole and in closing, colleges and universities, I argue, have historically, but I also believe currently, provide a talent pipeline and are also a rock during economic transition. Former Mayor Carl Dean told me in an interview that the only entity that was really building in Nashville during the Great Recession was Belmont and Lipscomb. So Nashville is a place of moderation, as is Tennessee in general, but it honors tradition, but it also seeks progress. And so looking at those three prongs, a formula for success, continuing to strive for diversity of business, which is commercial, music and entertainment with cultural, and higher education, which is that intellectual aspiration. And so ultimately then, as I said at the very top, a new project that I'm working on is a digital project with the Metro Historical Commission. I don't know if it'll actually let me get to the website because I haven't signed on to the Wi-Fi here. But it's just NashvilleSites.org, and the Metro Historical Commission is sponsoring it. We are in the process of fundraising, and we're getting very close to our goal. We've built one tour that has 25 sites, and the idea is that it's mobile-friendly on your phone. And as you're walking around downtown, there'll be signage downtown, but also some advertising. And so that it's both educational and engaging is the plan. If we get the funding, which we hope to have by the summer, we're going to expand to 25 tours and about 400 different sites. And a lot of these are interchangeable, lots of cross-reference points, and it's prescribed tours, but also built in a way that you can customize as you go, depending on your interest or your location. So thank you so much for coming and for listening and being so attentive. And if you have any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer them. And I almost stayed to 45 minutes.
Questions?
Yes, ma'am.
I worked at Cumberland University of Lebanon, Tennessee, mm-hmm. in their office for a short period of time. Mm-hmm. And my memory is that there was also a Cumberland College Mm-hmm. How early was it?
So Cumberland College, actually, the easy answer for that is that it was, in some part, a descendant of the University of Nashville, and moved out to Lebanon, and it was really famous for its law school. It was one of the big Southern law schools, and they also had a college preparatory division as well. So it did come out of Nashville, but ultimately was not really considered, after it moved out, especially in those days, getting to Lebanon was quite a trek. But yeah, it was originally part of that University of Nashville system.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great question, Trevecca. And there were a lot of schools that that I mentioned either in the introduction or I mentioned in the last chapter where I say, hey, I know that I haven't really talked about these schools throughout the book, and here's why. And Trevecca is one of them. Trevecca started off really as a church school, obviously, but not one that really conferred diplomas. And so they were mostly downtown Nashville, and then they moved a couple of different places, and then ultimately came back to downtown Nashville, where they are today. But I'm trying to remember the exact year they were accredited, but they weren't actually accredited as a college until after the 1950s. So I mentioned them, and I talk about, in the last chapter, I actually mentioned them and talk about, they have soaring enrollment right now, too. They're also growing by leaps and bounds. But they didn't really fit the purview of this book because they weren't very active before 1930. Another one that falls into that is the American Baptist Seminary, where John Lewis attended. But it was also a school that was around in the teens, but didn't really form as a college until after 1930. So that's where those two. And then a third would probably be Aquinas College, which is a Catholic college, and it's same thing. It wasn't accredited until later. Although it did exist. Accreditation was a weird thing back then because we all have SACs today, Southern Association of Colleges and Schools, but SACs and all of these other accrediting agencies, they were also coming of age in the early 1900s. So even a lot of these schools that I mentioned, that I talk about in the book, didn't get accreditation until later in the period. Vanderbilt was accredited in 1895, Fisk was not accredited until 1930. Ward Belmont was accredited as a junior college in 1926. So the whole country was having to figure out what was a college, because a lot of people were calling themselves colleges and universities, and they weren't. And I was going to say, which is yet another pattern that we've seen pop up, except for the fact that a lot of the schools are accredited, and I think that's part of the issue today. It's not the schools, but rather the agencies.
Was there not also a college out West End spread in several old buildings across from West End High School?
Yes, I believe you are talking about, well, either Aquinas College, which is across the street from MBA, Montgomery Bell Academy, not that one. I believe you're talking about, this. That was another Bible college. I am blanking on the first name of it, but it has since gone out of business. Yes, ma'am.
You also say that the educational process gave rise to the business that we really see in Nashville now.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, I'm talking about Nashville, but we're here in Bowling Green, and I think you could say very much the same thing. It's a huge part of your community and your economy. And I think because Nashville... I think Nashville's distinction, and the other southern city, by the way, that is also doing this is Atlanta. Atlanta's also doing, but Atlanta's doing so many other things that are different from Nashville. It's a different kind of city. But Nashville decides they really want to really use education as their platform. And they're very, it's in all the brochures, it's in all the literature that's going out about the city is, that Nashville's not a good, not just a good place to come and do business, but a good place to learn, and then a good place to live. And they really market that very, as I said at the beginning, they very distinctively market that and use that as a marketing tool.
You talked about football for men. Were there sports for women?
Yeah, that's the great question. And if I had another hour, so that's really like part two of the lecture. Women's sports, and you mentioned that I was an athlete in high school in my former life. My original interest in this period, the Gilded Progressive period, when I was at UT Knoxville, as you might imagine, was women's basketball. I wasn't playing any longer, but I sure was interested in the history of it. Especially when you see those pictures, and there are several in the book, where the women are wearing, you know, these huge bloomers, and you're like, what are they wearing, and you know, how are they playing? And in fact, the first game in Tennessee was played between Ward Seminary and Vanderbilt, and the score was 0-5. And I know you're thinking, like, how did they get there? Baskets were worth 5 points apiece, so there was really one basket to none. One basket scored, and men were not allowed in the gym because it would be scandalous to see women, I guess, sweating and, you know, wrestling, I don't know. But my historical research and interest began as a senior at the University of Tennessee, writing a senior thesis for the history department, and it was about women's sports coming of age, and I called it, you know, the first generation from Victorian attitudes to athletic victories. And I guess I could just say, to just kind of sum up for here and now, I talk about it extensively in the book, so go for that, chapter two. But for this, it's a key part of what makes the modern belt. And if I could, I will just real quickly, I'll read you one quote that I think epitomizes this, if I can find it in the right place. So there was, in 1903, in the annual for Ward Seminary, there was the senior, her name was Agnes Amos, and she wrote two different passages about women, and one she called her ideal, she called my ideal, and then the other she called it the ideal and the other. And so she says, my ideal, like the other, is preparing for college, but oh, the difference between them. Miss Ideal is quite a studious girl who's very fond of her books and stands high in her classes. She scorns with a poo at any mention or allusion to a boy or a beau. She takes any caller that she might happen to have out to play tennis or ball or runs races with him. She's very proud of her prowess in athletic sports, and in fact is fond of telling how she distanced her boyfriend in a foot race. She spends much of her time on books and likes nothing better than to dream of Wellesley, herself in cap and gown, as part of the landscape. In personal appearance, she almost approaches the masculine, wears her hair parted and pulled back, and has a disregard for style, and yet she has a distinct style all around. She's a jolly good fellow. Lady Other, on the other hand, she writes about this too, she is entirely different, for she is a graceful feminine creature, cares much for style, not the same sort as Miss Ideal's. However, her desires are the opposite. The delights of her heart are dancing balls, bows, parentheses, really true ones, close parentheses, and to be a real young lady. She's the same in school as she is out. She's very frivolous and light, but beneath that runs a strong current of the good and the noble. Taken in all, they are very different, yet quite attractive in each their own way. And so I always think that that's one of those goldmine quotes where you see it and you're like, man, I got it. This is going to lead the chapter. But I think she is perfectly describing the world into which young women born after the Civil War and certainly born after 1890 were trying to navigate. And it was one of, as I mentioned, convention and compromise that they were trying to figure out. So, yes, the modern bell really is a white construction. I had a section, there's an entire chapter that's just dedicated to African-American education, but what you find throughout the book, because all college students are a part of this narrative, and so I didn't want to compartmentalize. At the same time, I wanted to highlight and really focus in certain chapters on particular groups. But you find black women throughout the book, and in the chapter on women, I refer to them as black bells, especially if you are talking about Fisk and Meharry. because they are, that picture you saw of 1930 with the women in that, they were very middle, upper class, middle class women, professional class women. The difference that I would really point out is that white women were lobbying for agency and services away from their husbands, right? Independence, so to speak. Whereas black women were arguing for agency and services for their husbands because they were still working on trying to enfranchise the entire community and they didn't have the right to vote. And in many cases, especially southern cities, they actually had greater success than black men in community activism because they didn't receive the same kind of pushback from the white community, and there were actually greater cooperation and biracial cooperation with a lot of the women, at least in Nashville.
Well, I want to thank you very much for...
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. You've been very kind.